Another thing that took off during World War II was polyvinyl chloride and plastics more generally. And of course, these would not only revolutionize domestic interior spaces with all sorts of plastic goods, but plastic packaging for food. Think of Tupperware containers, Saran wrap so you can, you know, keep leftovers fresh in the fridge.
Welcome back to Food, a Cultural Culinary History, a podcast brought to you by The Great Courses Plus. I'm Jason Smeagol. Like you, I'm a lifelong learner. I've been listening to The Great Courses for over 14 years, and I'm excited to be sharing this great course as a podcast with you. This podcast is hosted by Ken Albala, who's professor of history and chair of food studies at the University of the Pacific. He's also the author of Ken Albala's Food Rant, a highly popular blog for people who love food. Episode 33, World War II and the Advent of Fast Food. During World War II, a whole host of new food technologies were developed to aid the war effort. In this podcast, we're going to explore how these technologies became the template for American eating in the post-war era. We'll see how freeze-dried and convenience foods, TV dinners, and chain restaurants shaped food culture. Then we'll take a look at the advent of fast food and the McDonald's business model that became a global phenomenon. As always, if you're interested in trying any of Ken's recipes and food experiments, or even seeing photos and illustrations of the concepts that Ken mentions in this podcast, you can find supporting materials for this podcast at thegreatcoursesdaily.com.
Today, we will focus on World War II, convenience food, which is eaten at home, and the advent of fast food. And these are topics that are more closely related to each other than we realize. Convenience foods were developed in the course of the war, and they became the template for foodways in the post-war era. As in World War I, adequate nutrition for soldiers and getting food to the front were again a major concern for the U.S. government during World War II. This time, the technology was in place to measure calories and nutrients necessary for maintaining health for the soldiers, but we might be surprised about what went into the average K rations. These were designed by physiologist Ansel Keys in the early 40s, and it was intended for short-term use by paratroopers and airborne divisions. It has to fit in a pocket, and it has to be edible cold. Keys also had to compromise with what soldiers actually wanted to eat. So these contained canned meat, crackers, chewing gum, cigarettes, a candy bar, plus a fruit-flavored powdered drink, or instant coffee and sugar. And all of this had to fit into a box the size of Cracker Jacks. And actually, the company that manufactured those boxes made these too. A standard C ration, which was for more regular use, had more canned foods, so that would have stewed meat, maybe a dessert. But notice how all of these foods became staples of the post-war kitchen, being sold, again, as easy and convenient. There were also broader effects of nutrition research during the war. Roosevelt had a special food and nutrition board organized to look into how food related to national defense. And in 1943, they came up with the recommended daily allowances. Now, it is easy to understand why they did this, but the very idea that there can be one universal set of guidelines for all people, that all people need about the same calories, the same nutrients, and should not receive more than a prescribed amount of things like fat and sodium, that should strike us as surprising, given what we've seen in this course. I mean, we know different human populations have lived and continue to live on radically varied diets. Some are extremely high in protein and fat, think of Eskimos. Some are almost entirely grain-based, and others are balanced in very different ways, either heavy on dairy or maybe on root vegetables. Nonetheless, the U.S. government decided to define good nutrition in terms that were so intensely culturally determined that they couldn't possibly apply to all the different peoples who now made up Americans. Meat, bread, dairy products were all emphasized because those were the major U.S. industries, and growers actually lobbied to have their products featured in the new guidelines. Cultural ideals and the shape of the ideal body also formed nutritional recommendations, which in the 1940s still meant a large, robust figure, because of course a good proportion of us still worked in factories where physical strength was needed. Today, obviously, recommendations are different because we have more sedentary lives and we work at desks. Well, it is impossible to assess the impact that the RDAs had initially, but it is clear that nutrition labeling, foods served in public schools as well as institutions, and what was considered healthy by the general populace was directly influenced by decisions that were made politically. The war, and specifically rationing, and other had other immediate impacts, though. The government wanted to send, again, those meats, fats, sugar, and canned vegetables to the front, believing they were more nutritious. And in this war, they were actually officially rationed back at home. There was a growing realization that the milling techniques actually destroy the nutrients in white bread that everyone was eating, so as not to become weak and unable to fight in the war, and including the home front, the government now required that all bread be enriched with thiamine, niacin, riboflavin, iron, and calcium. And of course, it still is today. Why they didn't just grind the whole grains and leave in those original nutrients, I'm not sure. But because millers were set up to make white flour, and because that's what the public learned to prefer as a marker of social class, this is what happened. The other important technology developed during the war was freeze drying. Now, of course, dehydration had been around for centuries, and dried meat is prehistoric. But freeze drying is different. It makes foods very dry, as much as 99% lighter. So then they can be easily shipped anywhere. And this allowed the government to send things like powdered milk to the front, dried eggs, mashed potato flakes, instant coffee, as well as dried vegetables. And you could put those into an instant soup mix, just add water and it becomes soup. Of course, all of this caught on like wildfire back at home after the war. You just add boiling water, no mess, no fuss. You don't even have to bother with a can opener. Historians have argued that this had an enormous negative impact on the culinary skills of many housewives. And there's still an ideal of female domesticity that liked to imagine the happy housewife at home baking cakes for her husband and children. But increasingly, these things came out of a box from Betty Crocker or from Duncan Hines. Never before has such rapid development of knowledge about food in a culture caused the almost total loss of knowledge by the general populace. And cakes are a perfect case in point. The original instant mixes actually contained everything you would need in the box. You just added water. But they still failed to catch on, and a marketing psychologist by the name of Ernest Dichter contended that they didn't really make people feel like they were actually cooking, but if you had to add a fresh egg and a little oil, then it made it seem like the cake was homemade. Now that's a ploy, ultimately, to sell more flour, but notice how it had the effect of de-skilling that generation that came to depend on mixes after the war. Another thing that took off during World War II was polyvinyl chloride and plastics more generally. And of course, these would not only revolutionize domestic interior spaces with all sorts of plastic goods, but plastic packaging for food. Think of Tupperware containers, saran wrap so you can, you know, keep leftovers fresh in the fridge. Aluminum foil also had become widely available for everyday use, so leftovers could go directly from the freezer into the oven. And this post-war prosperity, think every single household had its own TV, it would be inevitable that food technologists would figure out a way to capitalize on young Americans' latest addiction by creating the TV dinner. This is essentially a civilian version of the war rations that were used on planes. It's a tin foil-lined disposable tray that had little separate compartments for each item. And you could actually stack them and ship them flat. And I think TV dinners are a sad commentary on the decay of sociability at mealtimes and the ritual sharing that cements families together. You know, given long commutes, working parents, you know, longer hours at work, These were marketed as being quick and convenient and ready at any moment. But people were no longer cooking with their children, no longer teaching them how to cook, no longer sharing those meals, or maybe even more important, no longer getting the pride and satisfaction of producing good food for one's family to enjoy. This phenomenon is, of course, linked to a dramatic rise in eating out as well, which is itself contingent on the fact that practically everyone now owns a car. They can drive anywhere they like to buy food or eat at a restaurant. And more people moving out to the suburbs, many of them in these vast areas of speckled with cardboard cutout houses that all look exactly the same. The Levittowns of the East Coast were the first and most successful planned communities. I actually grew up in one. Well, apart from the fact that they built these right on top of farmland, which of course forces farmers to move further afield, the physical separation of houses, each with their own half or quarter acre, and zoning laws that prevented businesses from being built near the houses, the businesses tend to be lined along the major roadways and away from people's backyards. And it was practically inevitable that what we would become eventually a car-dependent culture. Remember all these roads being built, new highways linking the suburbs to the cities, and that's where most of the jobs still remained. It meant that restaurants built along these highways would flourish, and people would tend to eat out a lot more. I think it is also important that most of these new restaurants were chains. That is, there were places that were familiar. You would recognize the name. You were less likely to be disappointed when you went in. You knew the menu, you knew the setting, and chain restaurants flourish for the same reason chain stores and name brands do. They can organize on a much larger scale. They can buy ingredients and ship them more efficiently. Instead of buying 20 pounds of tomatoes, let's say for a daily sauce in a restaurant, for a chain, you can buy several tons. You can process them in a central facility and then supply each restaurant in the chain. And chains can also afford huge advertising campaigns that make sure everyone in the country recognizes their product and their brand. A little privately owned restaurant can't do anything like that. And really, only diners and small ethnic restaurants tend to remain privately owned. Apart from being chains, many of these restaurants also served what we now recognize as fast food. And the novelty here was that you could either drive up and be served right in your car by car hops, or you could go in and eat quickly and get right back on the road. And the earliest versions of these actually go back to 1919. A&W Root Beer in Lodi, California claims to be the very first. But fast food is not a uniquely American phenomenon, right? There are street vendors selling a kind of fast food in ancient Rome. And most cultures, of course, have street food that is very fast. But this is food that is meant to be driven to in a car. And what makes this phenomenon unique is that the stores use the assembly line production that is modeled on Ford, ultimately. These were franchised. They're of uniform structure and the decor throughout the country. And they serve a preset menu made with ingredients that are pre-prepared on an industrial scale. That's to say, the French fries are pre-cut and frozen. The hamburger patties are all preformed. Everything can be put together by a person with practically no skills beyond pressing a button or flipping that burger over. And that's maybe the most important part about a fast food chain, is that the labor is generally unskilled. And that means it's completely expendable. As you know, it's usually teenagers, and they can pay these people very little. They don't have to offer them benefits. And the company doesn't have to spend time on training. And yet, because of the machines and the production line approach to manufacture, they get a very uniform and predictable product nonetheless. Well, first, let me say from the outset that I don't believe that fast food necessarily tastes bad. Okay, it is engineered to taste good. It's got the fat and the salt and the sugar, and all of which we may have actually evolved to crave. It's also got flavor additives. It would not have sold so well if it actually tasted bad. I always think maybe the only thing they're missing is alcohol. You know, if they served beer at McDonald's, I think they would have taken over all the entire restaurant industry long ago. But I guess driving made that a bad idea. And especially they're serving families. But you know, as an aside, they do serve wine and beer at McDonald's in France. And I think the difference is that most stores are actually in cities and people don't have to drive to them. And I also think most Frenchmen wouldn't set foot in a restaurant if they didn't serve wine. But anyway, back to the story.
If you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts, the new audio and video streaming site from The Great Courses, the leader in lifelong learning. Featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from electronics, cooking with vegetables, the Gilded Age, skywatching, building your vocabulary, mind-body medicine, and a whole lot more. The Great Courses Plus. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.
On the one hand, you know, many French people are violently opposed to McDonald's, and in fact, they sporadically attack them as a political statement. In 1999, José Bové deconstructed an entire McDonald's store nail by nail and without destroying anything. On the other hand, the French are McDonald's number two market, and the stores are owned by French investors, and they're patronized by French people. You know, no one forced this on them. Nor were the other McDonald's restaurants in 119 countries worldwide, with more than 33,000 restaurants serving nearly 68 million customers every day. Very recently, the end of 2010, Subway actually surpassed those numbers globally. But needless to say, fast food is now a global phenomenon. It's also very interesting how McDonald's or even native fast food restaurants are thought of very differently around the world. In China, for example, since they had a one-child policy, the parents tend to lavish special attention to their children. So they will throw parties at McDonald's, and they can last for hours and hours. It's anything but fast. And it seems, you know, completely at odds with the idea that we have of what fast food means in the U.S. In some countries, oddly, it's also very expensive, and it's considered a special occasion to go out for what they consider American food. You know, it's burgers and fries. You know, the classic story is when a McDonald's opened in Moscow, it broke all opening day records. They had lines miles long. And now the interesting thing is there's a Russian sort of version of fast food that's right beside that original McDonald's. And often, another thing is that local tastes will be accommodated. I love how in Japan they serve a teriyaki McBurger. In Turkey, they have a kifte burger made with lamb and a yogurt sauce. Naturally, there are kosher McDonald's in Israel, and of course, they don't serve cheeseburgers. In Sweden, there is a McSki ski-through window, so you can have a hamburger and never have to get off your skis, which my favorite is in India, there's a mutton burger, can't have beef, but it's called a Maharaja Mac. And they also have a vegetarian McAloo Tiki burger trademark for observant Brahmins. Well, despite this, many people around the world fear that their children who grow up eating fast food will no longer want to eat according to their own traditions. And returning to this question of taste, I don't think there's really any point in comparing a homemade hamburger with a fast food version. The former is made from fresh ground beef that costs maybe $1.99, $2.50 a pound. If you cook it on a grill, that takes, 5 to 7 minutes? I mean, it's nothing really complicated. And you can cook that homemade burger exactly the way you like. You add the condiments you prefer. It's fresh. And a fast food burger usually costs more. The patty is preformed if it's not actually pre-cooked somewhere else. It's reheated on a flat top, or in some cases, microwaved. I've seen that happen. And if you look closely at it, it has this kind of grayish color and a texture that's slightly rubbery. And I think the sauce that goes all over it is ultimately to mask that flavor. And in the end, it tastes nothing like a homemade burger. And when someone eats them because it's the only food available and there are no supermarkets in an area, which is the case if you think about some inner cities that are food deserts, then I think something has really gone seriously wrong. Let me offer just a bit of historical background to McDonald's, which is the place that really set the model for the whole modern fast food sector. Maurice and Richard, Maurice's nickname is Mac, McDonald, opened their first restaurant in Pasadena in 1937, and they moved it a few years later to San Bernardino. And the whole idea was that they would serve food quickly, they'd have an enormous turnover, and they'd keep the price as low as possible. And essentially, they would apply the principles of assembly line manufacture to food preparation. But the key to their success really came after World War II, when they decided to do away with waiters and car hops, the kind that you would use at drive-ins. And they also did away with busboys and dishwashers. And the idea was that everything could be self-service. They also dramatically reduced the menu. You weren't allowed to make substitutions. And that way they could just sort of churn out this food on a massive scale. And especially because the working space was streamlined and it was automated as much as possible, remember Taylorism? Well, those principles are applied to the physical space of the fast food restaurant. In the early 50s, the McDonald brothers decided to start franchising the business. And what that means is that you sell the name for a fee, build a restaurant, and then a private investor operates it, but he has to buy the ingredients from the mother company. And in 1954, they hired Ray Kroc to handle their franchising business. And at this point, they only had one store. What Kroc did is build this into an empire. He eventually actually bought the whole company. The combination of assembly line procedures, scientific management, franchising, a brilliant advertising campaign, that meant the company kept growing and growing. And eventually, every single town in the country had one or even many more McDonald's. In fact, at last count, I think the city where I live has 14. Now, apparently, McDonald's chooses the site. They use satellite photography to predict where the sprawl will occur. And then they build the physical building. Most operators actually pay rent to the corporation. And that's where most of their profits come from. All the equipment and the ingredients also have to be bought from the corporation. The idea of using assembly lines and franchising eventually catches on like wildfire. And in the first few years of the 1950s, a whole slew of people went to check out this new McDonald's, and they imitated it. Burger King, for example, was founded in 1953. Wendy's appeared very shortly thereafter. And other restaurants selling different kinds of foods followed, but they're all using the same model. So Taco Bell appeared, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Domino's Pizza. And clearly, the popularity of fast food has a lot to do with convenience, right? There are more women in the workforce, more people living by themselves who are disinclined to cook. It also has to do with more disposable income. People can afford to eat out more, and that whole baby boom generation was targeted and became, some people argue, addicted to this kind of food. And I do think it is a kind of addiction, maybe not a chemical addiction, but certainly a psychological one. Think of the crisp, salty, and slightly greasy crunch of a French fry. And there are actually psychologists who make their living trying to understand why people crave crunchy foods. They claim it has to do with a kind of displaced libidinal aggression, which I guess makes sense if you're a Freudian. But the idea is that the sensation of biting down and hearing things break maybe replaces that instinctual urge that we evolved to enjoy of chomping on flesh and crunching into bones. And notice how the hamburger is actually a little bit too big to fit in your mouth, right? You have to grasp the whole thing carefully, open your mouth really wide, and bare your teeth, and then stuff the thing in much as you would like an antelope's leg or something like that. And instead of blood dripping down your cheek, you have this ketchup going all over the place. I know this sounds silly, admittedly, But this is apparently the logic to why they're this shape and size and with those contents. Well, apart from the aesthetics of fast food and why we may like it, let's look at the effects that it produces. An unforeseen byproduct of the fast food industry is waste. Because they don't want to spend time washing dishes and silverware, those are replaced with disposable packaging. And they've actually gotten much better in recent years, probably for concern out of the environment and public pressure, but the once styrofoam containers for the hamburgers, much of it is now paper. The only problem is that the huge piles of styrofoam that never biodegrade, and I think is actually made of petroleum, so it's a pollutant. But paper is much better. Nonetheless, it's still an enormous waste. Let me give you some figures. 1.8 million tons of fast food packaging are wasted every year. And that's a recent figure. That apparently makes up 20% of all waste. As you know, the biggest gripe against fast food has been the effect it's had on health. And people have even tried to sue fast food companies for becoming obese, as if they had no choice but to eat there, or as if they didn't realize what was happening to them. But anyway, we can look for ourselves at the nutritional labeling that's now by law available to customers. And my instinct is that the people who eat this food aren't really concerned and are not really going to leave because of what the labels say, but the information is always a step in the right direction. So this is what the nutritional facts claim. They may be a little old, but this is what you could find on a website now. And in fact, I think the sodium levels have risen very recently to boost sales. But interestingly, McDonald's actually doesn't take the cake here. It is a Big Mac that comes in at 540 calories with 29 grams of fat and 1,040 milligrams of sodium. But Burger King's Whopper beats them at 670 calories and 40 grams of fat, or even better, a double Whopper with cheese, which has 990 calories and 65 grams of fat. And if you combine that with 340 calories for small fries that have 15 grams of fat, and maybe a 30-ounce cola that has 290 calories, well, or maybe imagine you'd like to splurge and have a chocolate shake with 580 calories for 12 ounces, and only 17 grams of fat. Well, that is practically dietetic compared to Dairy Queen's large chocolate malt shake, which has 1,030 calories. But our Burger King meal, nonetheless, comes to a whopping 2,200 calories. And the government, remember, says 2,000 calories a day is about right. And 90 grams of fat. We're supposed to eat 65 on the 2,000 calorie diet or 80 on the 2,500 plan. And I won't even go into the sodium or cholesterol or the fact that it doesn't contain dietary fiber, but sometimes positive good can result from the power that fast food chains wield. For example, demanding that their suppliers improve standards for raising chickens and abandoning battery-raised farming, you know, those stacked tiny little cages that they would put chickens in, when McDonald's stopped using those, they changed the entire industry immediately. Another consequence of fast food is the way that it is marketed specifically to children. Happy Meals include toys, and they're based on movies that are released at the same time. And of course, it's a way for Hollywood to advertise and a way for the fast food chain to attract children. But the strange irony is that even if a movie flops, it can make a fortune by selling toys through McDonald's or Burger King. And apparently McDonald's is one of the nation's largest distributors of toys. Fast food also advertises during children's programming in an attempt to form brand loyalty, and even in public schools, which sometimes accept money to help pad their dwindling budgets. Fast food is also now finding other outlets. It is appearing at stadiums, in airports, you find it very easily, in Walmarts, in zoos. They tried on airplanes themselves for a while. Gas stations have little quick fast food marts. And even apparently in hospitals. Does that make sense? Apparently every day, the equivalent of 1 in 4 adults in the United States visits a fast food restaurant. Here's some other frightening facts. In 1970, Americans spent about $6 billion on fast food. In year 2000, more than $110 billion, which is more than what is spent on higher education, computers, or even new cars. And the latest figures I could find were $240 billion per annum, which is more than double what it was a decade ago. The figure that absolutely astounds me, or at least this is a claim made by Eric Schlosser, is as much as 90% of all new jobs in this country are created by the McDonald's Corporation at any given time. One in five people in the U.S. have worked at a McDonald's. And annually, they hire as many as 1 million people. Of course, there's a huge turnover, but that is more than any other corporation, public or private. In 1968, they had only 1,000 restaurants. Now they have more than 33,000 worldwide and open about 2,000 new ones every year. McDonald's is also the nation's largest purchaser of beef, pork, and potatoes, which means if you want to sell potatoes, you have to grow the kind that work in McDonald's cutting machines and fryers, and those are russet Burbanks, which is the exact same spud you see in every supermarket. That means that you are getting the results of fast food in a supermarket, even if you never set foot in a McDonald's. McDonald's is also the largest owner of retail property in the world. In fact, they make more money on rent than selling food. A survey of American school children showed that 96% know Ronald McDonald. More people on Earth recognize the golden arches than the cross. And of course, fast food was scarcely the only option, as we will see in the next lecture. The latter half of the 20th century also witnessed a food counterculture, a growth of interest in cooking, as well as a renewed interest in whole food that is sustainable, healthy, and environmentally conscious. And we'll look at that next.
Thanks for listening to episode 33 of Food, A Cultural Culinary History. Just a reminder, if you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts. Featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from strength training, the Etruscans, dark matter, conflict management, how to write great sentences, you name it, at The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.